Welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review. Our several-year mission will be to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. We will be reviewing every Star Trek comic book ever published. These stories have been released by Gold Key, Marvel, DC, Malibu, Wildstorm, Tokyo Press, IDW, and others. Star Trek and all that the Star Trek universe contains is copyrighted by CBS Studios, Inc.
Hello and welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review with Donovan again. Episode number 434, recorded September 22nd, 2024.
So as of September 2024, we are caught up on comics, and we still wanted to stay in Star Trek, unlike doing some other random stuff, which I still like doing. But staying in Star Trek, we thought we would start doing some of the Star Trek short stories that are out there, especially the ones that have been recently released in magazine form, mostly in Star Trek Explorer magazine. So if you buy those issues digitally, you get four short stories an issue. If you buy them off the news rack, you get two short stories. So a little bit of an incentive to get them digitally. But yeah, short stories are pretty good so far.
Yeah, it's a great source. And there's so many of them. How many issues are out now? 13? 12? 14?
11 issues at the time of recording.
11.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's like 44 short stories that are out there.
There you go. Not bad. And I've only read two, the two we're doing today. And and they're both good. And they're nice and short. They're easy. They're easy reads. So they're quick and easy. Not a big investment of time. And sometimes short stories are really, really good.
Yeah. A lot of times I don't like short stories because I can't get into them, or by the time you get into them, the story's already over kind of thing. But so far, the ones I've read of this, they're really good because they're characters you already know. So there's a little bit of a shorthand where you're coming into something that you're already familiar with. Yep. But yeah, and they're all by authors and stuff that have done, for the most part, tons of other Star Trek expanded media stuff. So I feel like they know their stuff.
Yeah. That Christopher Cooper, who did the first story we're going to do with Q and Kirk, it was very interesting seeing at least part of his resume. He has written for a lot of stuff.
And I think he's the editor of the magazine, isn't he?
He was an editor of this magazine. There's multiple editors.
So I got some notes about the two authors that we're covering today at the end, if that makes more sense to talk about it there.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay. All right, so we just literally eyeballed the titles and randomly picked two stories to cover. So I chose the Q Kirk meetup that was in issue number one. And Ken, you know, being a big fan of Garrick, saw that there was a Garrick-centered story, and he picked that from issue number seven, I believe.
Yes.
So
that's what we're doing today.
That's what we're doing today. Any other housekeeping, or should I just jump into it real quick?
Let's just jump into it.
All right. So the first story we're covering is All That Most Maddens and Torments. So this was in issue number one. All the short stories in issue number one were all Q-themed. The story here was written by Christopher Cooper, and there was one illustration by Klebs Jr. It's a fairly short story. All of these are only like 4 pages long. So my synopsis will be brief here. So Captain Kirk finds himself on the deck of an 1800s whaling vessel. At first, the reader is maybe thinking that this is a holodeck or a proto-holodeck, but then we realize that Kirk also seems disoriented. And then a man in a funny admiral uniform shows up and introduces himself as Q. So now you know that this is something else. So through the conversation between Kirk and Q, Kirk learns that he's actually inside of the novel Moby Dick. He sees another ship called the Perquod coming up, and it's captained by Ahab, who in this version looks just like Wrath of Khan Khan. Q, for his part of this conversation, is just trying to figure out what makes this man such a legend. At one point, Kirk does spring into action to save some whales from Ahab. And then he kind of snaps out of it and realizes what's going on. He asks if the Enterprise B is safe. Q says that it is, and he lets slip that Kirk is in something called the Nexus. Kirk is then whisked away to another illusion, this time on board his Enterprise, with Spock and Sulu by his side. Q tries to depart from the illusion, but finds that he cannot. Kirk says that he's figured it out, that he's in control of this reality, and he can keep Q here for as long as he wants. Q asks if Kirk really wants to spend all of eternity together, and this is enough to convince Kirk that the irksome being is not the companion that he wants, and he allows Q to disappear. Kirk is then ready to live out his alternate histories in peace, waiting for his destiny with a man named Picard. The end.
I like that one. That was good.
Yeah, I did too. I was a little on the fence about a Q-Kirk meetup, but I really like the way they did it here.
Me too. I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, what time period is this? At what point is Kirk? A nice drawing of him, of Kirk and Q, and Kirk is in his Wrath of Khan uniform. So either that is or isn't a hint. But then, as the conversation keeps going, and you realize that, oh my God, this is generations. This whole thing isn't Q's making. Kirk right. just entered the Nexus. It's like, oh, well, that's cool. I was not expecting that. I thought that was
cool. Yeah, and if you look at that artwork, which is beautiful, by the way, I probably should have mm-hmm. I should have described it kind of like a cover. But yeah, the cover gives it away. I mean, it shows the Nexus behind Kirk and Q. So Kirk and Q are like staring at each other. And then behind mm-hmm. them, you see the Nexus. So it should not have been a surprise. But I too, was surprised. I was like, what's going on? You know, and then he brought up the Enterprise B. And I'm like, oh, it's the Nexus.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So you're right. The ribbon, the energy ribbon or whatever is behind their heads. When I looked at the picture, which I also think is a very nice drawing, it did not say to me, oh, the Nexus. Nope. It's just another one of those, you know, celestial backgrounds to spice things up. Instead right. of just a star field, they've got some kind of a power ribbon that looks just like the Nexus.
But once you know, you're just like, oh, man, how once did you I know, catch exactly. that?
Exactly. I agree.
Yeah, so it was good.
I thought that was good. They didn't just do a... Oh, Q just whisked him off, Kirk off and is playing with him. No, it's actually Kirk who's in charge of this little dream. And it's in the Nexus. I thought that was great. Another thing that I thought was really good is, and you had mentioned in the synopsis, the point where Kirk realizes that he is not in the normal world. I mean, he is not a ship, a sailing ship captain. And then he starts remembering who he is. And then he says to Q, but I have to know the ship out of danger, which is like, well, that's pretty much what Spock said in Wrath of Khan at the end when he was close to dying. So they use the similar wording. But then it's like, yes, that makes perfect sense. Kirk didn't know whether he was able to save the Enterprise B and all those people.
Right.
So, yes, that makes so much sense that would be the first thing Kirk would want to know once he got his bearings and realized temporally where he is right, or what time right. period is and remembered what reality is really where he came from. So that was so Kirk.
Yeah.
And then what Q does is so Q. Anyway, I thought they were very true to the characters.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I know Moby Dick, but I've never read it. But here I'm reading this, and I'm like, okay, I'm catching some of the Moby Dick references. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I even love, I loved when Q says, oh, you have a familiarity with whales, right? And then I'm like, oh, that's so beautiful, because he yeah. saved George and Gracie. Yeah. And then when he's talking about Ahab's ship being the Pequod, and then Q's like, Picard? And he's like, no, the name of the ship. I loved it. Oh, it was so good. I was like, how have they never made that reference before? All the Moby Dick references in First Contact, they never mentioned that Picard's name is very close to the name of Ahab's ship.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's close, but isn't that close. I thought it was cute. I mean, he says the Pequod. So as soon as he says the Pequod, okay, yeah, Moby Dick. I did attempt to read Moby Dick once. And I got maybe 50 pages into it, and it's a long book. And it's kind of boring, at least at the beginning. So it's a bit of a slog if you ever want to try
I'll be honest. I read this a few weeks ago, and then after I read this, I got the Classics Illustrated graphic novel of Moby Dick. So I started trying to read that, and I couldn't really get into it. But
yeah, it's very wordy, unnecessarily wordy. A commentator said that back in those days, a lot of times you were paid by the word. So,
oh, really?
Part of the reason why it's so long and wordy is because that he made more money that way, supposedly. At least that's what this commentator said about it.
Well, and they didn't have TV and stuff to vie for your attention. So as a consumer, that would be good. The longer the book, the longer I get to read it. You know, I'm not trying to read it in between episodes of The Cosby Show or whatever it is that's vying for your attention.
And back then, we had not reduced our attention span to that of a tsetse fly. So people could actually read books that took a little while to unfold themselves.
Right.
But when he said, it's the Pequod, and then Q's eyes widened and a look of genuine shock flashed across his face, it was like I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, Q? Surprised by anything? Q's never surprised by anything. And then he said, did you say Picard? He's like, oh, that's funny. I like it.
No, it was hilarious.
I like it. That's good.
But Q did get surprised there at the end when Kirk figured out that he was in control of the whole universe.
Yeah. Really? I mean, really, Q couldn't have left if he wanted to leave? Really? I mean, I don't know. There's something about that just seemed like BS, but yeah.
Right. And he seems like he's very, I mean, this is supposed to be like right after he gets sucked into the Nexus, or at least that's the way I took it.
Yes, me too.
But then by the time he meets up with Kirk, he doesn't seem to be in control of anything. It just, you know, stuff's happening. You know, he's riding a horse, and then his girlfriend's calling him from the other, you know, the cabin or whatever, and it's just like he's just living out these lives that he wished he had, but he doesn't seem to be controlling it like he is here with Q. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
Good point. That does seem a little inconsistent.
But time is funny there in the Nexus, so.
It is funny. Yeah, because so time feels different, so it seemed, didn't he say it was like, from his point of view, Kirk just arrived when Picard showed up?
Well, in the movie, yeah. But then in the book, they kind of explain that he's been living it over and over again, and a lot of his different loves have been his wife. You know, that voice in the cabin, you know, at one point it's Carol Marcus, at one point it's somebody else. You know, all these past loves and stuff. He's kind of like reliving the, what would have happened if I didn't break up with her or whatever, if she didn't die.
Right.
Yeah, so a little bit of wish fulfillment while he's there in the Nexus.
Cool.
But no, overall, really love this book, this story. And you were mentioning the author, Christopher Cooper. Mm-hmm. I've listened to, he's done a lot of Doctor Who radio plays.
Yeah. So
I've listened to quite a few of those. And I'm a subscriber to the Doctor Who magazine. And he's written a lot of the comic strips that are in those magazines. So I've definitely read his work before.
Right. And the idea that he wrote for Doctor Who, he wrote for Torchwood, novelist, comic strip writer, cartoonist, and playwright. So he's a playwright too. That's great. And the idea that he would be writing for other sci-fi franchises makes perfect sense.
Right. So and Titan Comics, who makes the magazine that we're reading now, and the Doctor Who magazine, you know, it's based in the UK. So getting him to do the Doctor Who, and then because he's familiar with, I guess, the management at Titan, they get him to do some of these short stories. Because he doesn't have a ton of other Star Trek experience, just these short stories and stuff in the magazines.
Right. Well, but obviously
he did a good job.
He did. Obviously, he's either a Star Trek fan because he brought up a lot of good things that he incorporated into this, or he does a lot of good research.
Right. Right.
Yeah. DC Fontana, somebody very associated with Star Trek. She wrote Babylon 5 scripts and Walton's Bonanza, The $6 Million Man. I mean, she's written for a lot of other things. So that makes perfect sense that people in a particular area would write for other franchises. That's pretty good.
Right, right. All right, anything else for this issue?
Just a few other things. They described... I'm not going to bother with that one. I have one more thing. Something was kind of cool in there when they first described the harpoon gun, which they were all loading, his crew was loading up, getting ready to shoot at Moby Dick. And then the Pequod pops up. And then Kirk realizes he doesn't want that whale to be dead this way. This is a sailing ship. You know, he wants to stop it. And then he sees, oh, Ahab is Khan. And so the whole thing's being set up that he's going to stop him, and he jumps down to the harpoon gun, and he's going to fire it, and then everything's kind of insinuating, and I guess Q thinks that he's going to try to shoot Khan with this harpoon gun.
Yeah, that's definitely what I thought.
That's what I thought. And then, but actually, that's the first thing I thought. Then I thought, well, he doesn't have to shoot Khan, because that wouldn't be a good guy move. What's he going to do? Is he going to try to shoot the... you know, the big steering wheel, the helm or whatever they call the big steering wheel thingy, the wooden thingy. And then he ends up shooting the rudder, you know, which is down by the water line in the back of the ship. And then they yank it back. And it's like, oh, that's smart. You can stop it from being able to steer, and then you don't have to hurt anybody. That's Kirk.
Right.
But then the rudder comes off. And it says it takes a big chunk of the back hull out. So then it's like, okay.
Sink the whole ship.
So it's going to sink the whole ship and everybody's going to die. So the first thing you thought, at least he would have just killed Khan, not the entire crew. And of course, this is before he knew this was all fantasy land anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Okay, yeah. Right. Okay. So on the one hand, I was like, oh, clever guy, Kirk. But if they don't have enough lifeboats, and even if the lifeboats don't reach dry land, you just killed everybody on that boat.
Well, I think maybe when he saw that it was Khan, then that's when he kind of realized that, hey, this is not
real.
Real, right?
Exactly. But he was still going for protecting the whale.
Right.
Even if it wasn't real.
You still don't want to see a fake whale die either.
Anyway, I thought that was clever. So, again, very Kirk. Kirk figures out the unexpected solution often.
Right.
So that was very Kirk also. So I guess the main thing is, I think this was a good story. It was fun. There was some interesting things in there. And it was very true to the characters.
Right. What I thought was interesting was that, you know, when they start making all the Moby Dick analogies and you're kind of like, okay, he's in Moby Dick. I assumed he was Ahab. So I really liked that they kind of spun it and was like, oh no, he's not Ahab, he's just some other ship that just happens to be in the book, you know, or in the story, this version of the book. I like that, because I was really expecting him to be Ahab, you know. That's he's sure. The main character on the book, or Ishmael.
Well, like Picard was Ahab in First Contact.
Exactly.
He was obsessed with the Borg.
Right. So I was glad that they played with that expectation too.
Right. Yes, pretty good.
That's it for me.
Okay. Shall we go to the next one? Issue 7 had a couple things that were Garrick related. They had a nice little story about Garrick, the character. You know, just like a documentary kind of, you know, things about the character and blah, blah, blah. Nice article. The issue 7 of Star Trek Explorer also had a nice interview of Jonathan Frakes. And I forgot the guy's name, but the guy that created the Enterprise G / Titan B for the third season of Picard. I forgot the guy's name, but he's a model maker. He's not professional or anything. But the folks that created the show apparently dug his spaceships, because he makes multiple models, full-size kind of models that could be used for a Hollywood production. And the guy's really good at it. And so they have an article about him in here, too. So this thing was packed with stuff that was in my wheelhouse. And so so that is following directly on the heels of the article about Garrick, is a nice little short story about Garrick called The Victim. So that is what we're going to be doing. So the published date of this issue 7 was May 2023, and the writer is John Peel, and the illustrator is Andy Walker, and the magazine editor is John Freeman. And the cover of the issue shows a photo of Jonathan Frakes, and he's in his Star Trek Picard Season 3 kind of civilian duds. And, you know, he looks concerned. Anywho, that's the cover. And then the artwork that leads into the short story is a nice full-page piece of artwork. And it shows Garrick in a very cool, kind of colorful, very stylish shirt, baggy-looking shirt. And he is standing up with his finger out and making a point to a lady who is seated at a desk. And from the back, I thought it was Kai Wynn or something, because it's like she looks like she's probably well into middle age, and she's got her hair up, and she's got a nice kind of nice looking dress. Hard to tell. You can only see her shoulders and her arm. Anyway, and then on the desk between the both of them is a Cardassian pistol. So that is what is setting the stage visually. "I'm afraid I'm here to kill you," Garrick states to Vedic Shawa after entering the religious woman's room late in the evening. The Vedic closes the door behind the civilian-dressed Cardassian that she quickly recognizes and addresses as Garrick, the station's tailor. Garrick's behavior makes it clear he does not want to kill Vedic, and his words confirm he is only following the orders of his superiors. The Vedic states her resistance to towing the Cardassian line has finally led to Garrick's visit this evening. Rather than trying to get out of her own murder, the Vedic calmly and rationally assesses both of their situations. A, she is fine with dying right now, but if it's the will of her gods, the prophets, then so be it. If Garrick does not kill her, then another assassin will be sent to do the job, and eventually Garrick will likely be killed too. Another point, she says he can kill her and still maintain his current feelings of opposition to how the Cardassians in charge are murderously clamping down on any whiff of dissent against them. And then finally, she makes it clear that Garrick should just go ahead and get it over with now. Garrick continues to delay and finally takes a gun from its concealed place in his clothes and puts it on the Vedic's desk, as if he's not going to shoot her. Finally, after a lot of back and forth, she picks up the gun and puts it in his hands. She presses his finger down on the trigger. The phaser discharges. The end.
I liked it. I like this one a lot.
Yeah.
I like that she basically kind of steered him to being, you know, he obviously has ideals here, right? He doesn't want to be a murderer, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But he's being told to be a murderer, and then basically, you know, she's saying, well, no matter what, I'm dead, whether you kill me or somebody else.
Yeah.
So you either kill me and then become the puppet they want you to be, or kill me and then, you know, try to make changes behind the line, yeah, behind the scenes.
Well,
and so I loved it. I loved
it. Did she
really
say that, or did she say, just keep your outlook on things, you know, still be your own man and not become their puppet and just give yourself over to them?
I don't remember the exact wording, but the way I took it was that,
I mean, this is not like Kirk talking to evil Spock saying, you've got to overcome the Terran Empire, because it's just not, you shouldn't do this.
don't think so. Basically, she was you kill me because no matter what, I'm dead. You kill me. You keep your own counsel, your own beliefs, and you work for them, but you don't.
But you don't buy into
but not
bullshit.
The orders that they are given. Yeah, you resist. You walk your own path. So I thought it. Then to me, that's Garrick. You know, he's always doing what they tell him to do, but kind of in his own way, so that he doesn't become a total villain.
Yeah. Well,
which
most
if you think about it, he is a villain, or was.
Well, he's one of those many characters that walk the line between villain and good guy. Mm-hmm. And I would propose that most of what we saw of Garrick on Deep Space Nine, not Tarek Nor, this is all takes place when it was Tarek Nor during the occupation. If you didn't get that out of my synopsis, that's what it was. But what we mostly know about him from the TV show is what he was like post-Tarek Nor, just the simple Taylor Garrick, you know? But you always knew there was more to him. But he was always a man of mystery. You figured he was a spy. But was he actively, or at least at some point in his life, he was a spy? But was he still spying for the Cardassians? Was he working for Gul Dukat, you know, while Captain Sisko, Commander Sisko, was in control of the station? You never knew. He was always a man of mystery. So a lot of his actions were not villainous. Anyway, so based this, okay, so my bottom line about this story, and I did not like this story as much as you did, because my outlook on Garrick is colored because I recently read Andrew Robinson's novel, A Stitch in Time. It's quite a long novel. I actually listened to the audiobook, and it gives you a ton of background on Garrick's life from the time he was a kid, and then he basically went through a set of schooling, which is like kind of like a military academy kind of thing. And he was a member of the Obsidian Order. I think we knew that already.
Right.
From the TV show. But he was definitely part of the Obsidian Order. And he, for a long time, he was doing their bidding. He was one of their spies.
And well, in that book, was his dad a tailor? Like it is there in this novel or in this short story?
I don't want to ruin it for you.
Ah, okay.
But the bottom line is, okay, so the man he thought was his father was a gardener. He was not a tailor at all.
Oh, right. I actually knew that.
Okay. But then his real biological father was not a simple man at all. So this is the stuff that I'm coming to the story with, which is not fair because what was in that novel, which I think is very good and I recommend in the book. I mean, if you are a Garrick fan and really want to know about him, not only his background, but also what happened to him after Deep Space Nine, that's a great book to read. Anyway,
right.
So my outlook is totally tainted by that. He did kill people before, so he was already a murderer.
Before he ever came to Tarek Nor?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the main reason he is at Tarek Nor is because of who he killed. He killed an important person in the Cardassian power structure. So he was sent to Tarek Nor, basically drummed out of the... What's the name of the spy organization? I just had a metal
Obsidian
block.
Obsidian Order.
Obsidian Order. So he was drummed out of the Obsidian Order, and he was sent to Tarek Nor as a form of expulsion and denigration. So he was not doing spying work, or at least he was not there for spying work. He was sent there to be literally the tailor. So the guy that was the tailor on Tarek Nor was gone for some reason. They needed somebody to do it, and forcing Garrick into that kind of a low class role gave Gul Dukat great heaps of joy, because Garrick, while he was Obsidian Order guy, there was a big rivalry between the Obsidian Order and the Cardassian military, and Gul Dukat's father was big in the military, and there was a reason that, well, Garrick was ordered to interrogate Gul Dukat's father, And he did. So they kidnapped him and they interrogated him. And the father kind of came to at times and recognized Garak's face enough that apparently Gul Dukat knew that he had done that to his father. So yeah. Gul Dukat had a big bone to pick with Garak. So he was not on, he was there to be denigrated and to be exiled. And he was not there to be a spy.
Right. So I am curious about that book, right? I mean, that book came out, I think, in the 2000s, right? Because it was one of the numbered Deep Space Nine books back when Pocket Books was releasing them every month, right? So it's kind of weird that
it's not a new one. It's
24 years later, they released the audiobook, and it's kind of being treated like a new book a little bit. But in reality, it's an older book, and, you know, they've we read the Coda book, so they've rebooted all of the expanded media, so it's kind of unclear whether that's canon or not. But I do, there's also a new book that just came out called Pliable Truths with that's a Next Generation book, and it takes place just before Deep Space Nine series starts. So Picard is actually on what's going to be Deep Space Nine, or just transitioning over to Deep Space Nine before Sisko comes in, right? So he's there as that first, like, Federation envoy that's kind of conditioning things or transitioning things over before Sisko shows up. And Garak's playing a big part in that story. I haven't read it yet. I wanted to.
Right.
So when I saw that this book, you know, is a fairly new book, right? It came out several months ago, this short story. So I was, like, wondering, I wonder if this short story kind of sets up or is at all setting up what's going to be mentioned in that Pliable Truth novel. So unfortunately I have not read that one. So I don't know if it contradicts this or if that contradicts the Stitch in Time. I should have probably read them all before we recorded this episode, but I only got so much free time.
Well, and you enjoyed it more than I did because you didn't have your mind tainted by these other stories.
Right. So, yeah, I am going to... That'll probably be my next Star Trek book. I just finished the Star Trek Discovery one about Tilly. For whatever reason, I had, like, zero interest in reading the Tilly book. Right. But, my goodness, I love that book. It was so good.
Oh, good.
I was, like, shocked on how good it was. And so, yeah, so, like, I'm like, all right, my next Star Trek book will be this Pliable Truths.
Stitch in Time. Oh, Pliable
Truths. No, Pliable Truths, right.
Okay.
Mainly because, you know, you keep talking about Garak, and then we just read this, so I'm like, ooh, I wonder if this ties into that at all. So if I come back in a couple weeks and say, hey, guess what? That's why. There was some sort of nod to this version of Garak from this story in that book.
Okay.
We'll see. Cool. We'll see. But anyways, yeah, I really enjoyed this book, or this short story.
Yeah. And I enjoyed it, but not nearly as much as you did, because there are things that are out of sync with what at least that novel said about Garak. And also, quite frankly, it presents, I don't think they're faithful to the character, at least not in my mind.
Right. Your version.
I mean, quite frankly, the Vedic, what was that?
Your version from reading the expanded media stuff, or you're saying even just from what you got from the Deep Space Nine.
Well, okay. So my take on Garak was always, he was a very situationally aware, smart guy. Okay. If he wasn't a spy, he sure seemed to be very aware of what's going on and very smart and very ahead of things. So, you know, the kind of guy who's a few steps ahead of most people and figuring out what his next moves are. That just seemed like the kind of guy Garak always was. And he's not that guy in this book at all. I mean, quite frankly, because he's not, he's a spy, but he's not an assassin. They're making it, quite frankly, they're making it seem like he's got no agency in this. That basically it's the Vedic who's pretty much controlling everything. I mean,
see, I didn't take it that way.
If Garak is the experienced spy, the smart operator, an intelligent person, he's going to walk into her office, quarters, whatever it is, and he's going to say, I'm here to kill you now, and the door's still open? Really?
Well, we don't know how we don't know what we don't know how old he is here, right? This could be like really early in his tenure as an operative, right? So this is like, you know, like James Bond getting his first 007 or 00.
Oh, so he became an operative at the age of 30 or 35.
That's what it says here.
Well, he didn't. He became an operative in his 20s when he was young.
According to what makes you think he's old here?
Okay. Well, how old was he in Deep Space Nine?
Mm-hmm.
He was probably, you know, in his 40s. And of course, he's an alien. So anyway, so let me just continue on. Okay. So I believe that at this point, he was an experienced spy. Okay. Even
yes, I agree.
I believe he was an experienced spy. I do not believe he was early in anything.
So you're saying he was an experienced spy in this short
story? He was an experienced. Yes.
Okay.
This was not his first posting. Tarek Nor was not his first posting. I do not believe that. And even if you had common sense, if you're going to come in to kill somebody, you're going to leave the door open? So she comes around, and she's the one that closes the door. So from the beginning of the story, it's the Vedic that's controlling what's going on. From the time she closes that door, and Garak bumblingly states, I'm going to kill you with the back door open. I mean, who knows if it goes into a hallway or what? I don't know. They don't tell you. But come on. I mean, even if you're just a common sense novice, wouldn't you probably close the door behind somebody? You're going to say, I'm going to kill you now?
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, and then all along, I mean, she's the one that's making most of the moves, and he's reacting to her. I mean, almost everything that's being said, he is reacting to her. And to the point at the very end where she's the one that pushes the trigger, not him. Right. I just thought it was not... I just didn't think it was that true to the Garak I know, even if I try to, and I know it's hard for me to do, but even if I try to filter out what I know about him from the novel, just what I knew of him from Deep Space Nine. I mean, he seemed to be an experienced, savvy operative of some kind. You didn't always know how much, but you do know. Wait, in Deep Space Nine, you knew that he was... Okay, so you're talking about like it's what, a 20-year difference between Deep Space Nine and when he was on Tarek Nor? I mean, he was a kid in his 20s on Tarek Nor?
This one definitely implies that he was here with his dad, right? Didn't it say? Or did he just learn, he learned how to be a tailor from his dad, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but I mean, nothing in this issue says that this is the first time he's been to Tarek Nor. I mean, she knew who he was. She says, oh, you're the tailor. So, I'm assuming he's already there.
Yes. He's already established. People know him. Right. I definitely have the understanding he has been the tailor there for some period of time. He's not a new thing.
Right.
I mean, she knew who he was. And who knows how long she's been there. I mean, she's probably been there a while. Mm-hmm. But how often does she need, you know, tailor services? I don't know.
Right. Well, I'm just surprised that they allowed Vedix on Tarek Nor back when
on
it
the
was
station,
a
period.
Yeah, when it was a slave ship. Yeah. I mean, basically, they were slave labor, right? They were beaming up the ore, and then these people were chipping it away. Why would they let a religious figure on and give her such free reign of the ship or the station? That seemed a little odd to me.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like she's in an office. Does it almost look like an office to you? It's got a desk. At least the drawing has a desk.
Yeah, and she's definitely decked out in her Vedic robes and stuff. So
exactly. Yeah. She is not working in the lines. She's not processing ore. So she is some kind of a liaison, some kind of a person that's there to help keep the slaves quiet.
Or, possibly, yeah.
I don't know. Because they've got control over Bajor, right?
Right.
I mean, that's where they're getting all the mining materials that they're processing up on the space station. Anywho. Anyway, I just didn't think it... I liked it. It was fine. I just didn't think it was as true to the Garrick character.
Yeah. And see, I kind of read it that this was very early in his spy career. You know, they're kind of like ordering him to kill somebody to prove his loyalty to the Obsidian Order. I mean, I didn't take this was like 5 years before it became Deep Space Nine. I was reading this like this was, you know, maybe decades before. You know, he was very young, really early in his spy career. Yes. And I liked that, you know, he had ideals. He didn't want to kill her, but she pointed out that, well, you're going to have to kill me no matter what. Just what are you going to do afterwards, right? After I'm dead, are you going to become their puppet or are you going to do your own thing?
Yeah, and exactly.
I liked it. I liked that
still,
a lot.
Still hold on to your soul. Because he was very secular, and she was, of course, very religious.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of back and forth and chatting back and forth about...
yeah, I like that, too. I mean...
About religious things.
That she was okay with dying. If that's what the prophets
exactly.
want
if that's
her
what
to
the
be
prophets,
dead,
exactly.
then she's not
going to
And
I will accept my fate.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
So, but as far as like divorcing yourself from expanded media, I mean, there was a comic book that we did that I think was it Wildstorm or Gold, not Gold Key. It might have been Marvel, but it was back with when they were one of them was doing a comic book. But anyways, in that one, there was an issue where Garrick is having like flashbacks, like PTS or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because he killed somebody there on the station, and then there's like somebody that looks just like that person that he killed on the station. So, I mean, in that story, I don't remember him having any qualms about killing her, but it's been a while since we read it. But but in that one, I think they even said that it was his first time on the station. So obviously it doesn't fit with the continuity of your book, the Stitch in Time, or the continuity of the short story. So, again, you just kind of have to, they've hit the reboot button a time or two since that issue came out, since that book came out, and now this short story came out.
Right.
So, again, I don't know.
Yeah. Like I say, I was tainted by the novel because he had a fairly significant Obsidian Order career before he ended up at...
Yeah, and this one, it definitely seems like he was assigned to Terek Noir very early in his career.
Yeah.
If he's already the established tailor of the station.
Yeah, but, and quite frankly, why would... I guess opportunities can pop up to hear things, but in general, why would you be a spy at your own station that's controlled by the military? I mean, would you hear? I mean, maybe you would hear things from the slaves. The slaves wouldn't be going into your shop. It's controlled by the military, right? At least that's definitely what the way they depicted it.
You always need to spy on your own people, right? That's the Obsidian Order way.
Well, no, you're right about that. You're right about that. But it's like, But what's interesting in the novel is. That's not why he was there at all. He wasn't spying on anybody. and just also mention, once the Federation and Bajor took over the space station, he still wasn't spying on, he was still not receiving orders to spy on anybody. They never asked him. They never contacted him to spy for them.
Oh, really?
Now, he trying to get the hell out of there and get back, you know, to get back to Cardassia, in the novel, he tried to transmit some information in the early days where there were Federation envoys that they were working out the details of the Federation withdrawal and that whole treaty that was going on. He tried to give them some information, but it was totally him trying to send it to them. They never asked him for it, the Cardassians. And they never responded to him.
Mm.
So they did use the information, by the way. But he was not a spy for them. Mm. Even after the Federation took over the thing again. It was kind of funny. I hate to ruin this for you, but when the Cardassians finally did pull out of Terek Nor, they did it overnight, and they didn't tell Garak. So in the morning,
they just left him.
They're all gone, and then he's left there because basically they don't want to take him with them. See, he's kind of a leper. He's a pariah. Gul Dukat hates his guts. So he's there, and he's like the only Cardassian there. And there's a lot of pissed off Bajorans that were slaves on that station. So anyway, kind of funny.
Well, if I get a chance, I'll read that one too. But I'm definitely going to do Pliable Truths first.
Yeah,
since, I'm in the middle. Since it's in the new continuity.
Cool. I'm in the middle. I'm gonna read that one next. But I'm in the middle of about three quarters of the way through a culture book, the fifth novel. So I'm going to finish that one. And I think I am going to read that. What's the name of it again?
Pliable Truths.
Pliable Truths.
Yes. Doesn't that sound really like Garak?
Oh, completely. Completely.
Just real quick, when I was reading this story, I've never watched the movie all the way through. I thought it was kind of boring and I fell asleep in it. But there was that Gary Oldman movie, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Oh, yeah.
So when I was reading this, for whatever reason, that title just kept running through my head. Oh, Garrick's a tinker, mm-hmm. or he's a tailor, he's a spy, he's a soldier. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wonder if that's why they made him a tailor. You know, I was just like, so I was spending a lot of time spinning maybe through that. So
right, kind of right, funny. Right.
But it had nothing to do with the story itself.
Right.
Just my brain.
Cool. And I never saw that movie, but my brother saw the movie, and he said that was really boring.
I started it, and I fell asleep. I started it all fired up. I'm like, I'm going to watch this one, and then I'm going to go back and watch the original Alec Guinness version. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't even get through that one, and I'm like, I'm not going to watch the old one because it's probably more boring than this one.
Than this one.
Anyways.
Yeah. John Le Carré or something like that. Novel.
All right. Based anything on. Else?
Nope. I got nothing else to say.
I feel a little bad. We spent more time talking about other books than this short story. Just about the author real quick. He also has John Peel. Has written quite a few Star Trek and, surprise, surprise, Doctor Who stuff that I've partaked in the past. As far as, like, Star Trek stuff, I mean, he wrote the Here Be Dragons. I think that was a one of those Lost Era books, like, where it was set, okay. Like, nope, I'm wrong. It was just one of the numbered pocketbook stuff. So, but I think I read that one back when I was a kid. It sounds very familiar. But anyways, very seasoned author of both Star Trek and Doctor Who. So,
cool.
A nice pedigree for a great. Good story.
I just wanted to mention that model maker guy that I couldn't remember his name. His name is Bill Krause.
Okay.
So he is the guy that created the Titan B / Enterprise G.
Okay.
That's also mentioned in the issue 7 of the magazine.
So, cool. You're suggesting that we read the magazine? Because all I read was the short stories.
Well, I think he's a very interesting model builder. So there's an example of somebody that was, a fan of all this kind of stuff, and then just became very good at model construction and designing and things like that. And then to have the fruit of your labor to actually make it into a video official Star Trek production is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Very awesome. Yes, and there's a Garak article here. So I think I'm going to go back and at least begin reading the Garak article just to see what it's saying.
Yeah.
So.
And the magazine's really, anyway. I mean, the magazine is nice. I mean, lots of cool pictures.
It's very nice.
A lot of good articles.
Very pretty.
I haven't sat down and read any of them. I just kind of skipped to the short stories. But what I've seen that looks good.
Yeah, it's right up our alley. I mean, it seems like it's a very high quality production. So
yep.
I was not even aware this thing existed. Now, so Star Trek Explorer is kind of like a morphed version of an earlier magazine. So Star Trek Magazine?
Yeah,
is that what it was?
Star Trek Magazine, yeah.
Okay. And the old Star Trek Magazine has been out for quite a while. It had a lot of issues. And then at some point, for whatever reason, it morphed into this.
Right. At one point, it was published here in the States, and then and then it was bought out by Titan, because Titan was kind of buying out all of the fan magazines. They bought out the Star Wars magazine and the Star Trek one around the same time.
Okay.
And then eventually they changed the name.
So it's because of the buyout. Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah. Well, this is something I'll be reading. I think I'll get a few more issues. Back issues.
Right. Yeah, make sure you get the digital one so you get those extra extra articles and extra short stories.
Yeah.
All right. Well, wrapping up this episode. Next episode, we should actually have two Star Trek comic books to actually review for the Star Trek Ongoing and the Star Trek Defiant series. What happens after Pleroma? That's the big one I'm looking forward to.
Exactly. The big cliffhanger. So that'll be Star Trek 2022 issue 24 and Defiant issue 19 to see what Worf and the Magnificent Seven are going to be doing against the onslaught of the Romulans.
Yeah, those farmers that they're training to be warriors.
Those simple farmers that somehow survived Hirogen attacks and Borg attacks.
And
they're still there.
Yep.
There's something going on with those guys. I don't know what it is, but something. Cool. I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
And there's also, we're not going to do this, but they did just come out with issue 500, Star Trek 500 issue. So that's, I know by the time we get this posted, that'll be old news, but that is a new one to us. We've just been leafing through very recently. Looks like there's some interesting stuff there.
Yeah, so we could either do that one as a standalone episode where we only do one issue, or we were thinking about pairing it up with a Lower Decks, I guess it's a graphic novel that's coming out, a choose-your-own-adventure graphic novel.
Right. So, and I really look forward to how that's going to work.
We could do both of those together, or we could just do each of them separate. We haven't decided yet.
Okay. Anyway, thanks, everybody, for joining us on the review.
Later.
Thank you for listening to Star Trek Comic Book Review. All Star Trek stories and characters are copyrighted CBS Studios Incorporated. All music, stories, and characters discussed are for entertainment purposes only. You can email us at startcomicbookreview@gmail.com. Visit us at our website, www.stcomicbookreview.com. Subscribe to us via iTunes. Or friend us on Facebook at first name ST Comic, second name Book Review. See you next time on Star Trek Comic Book Review.
Let's get the hell out of here.